Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Hi, everybody.
Steve, did it ever occur to you that when the door is closed, we're trying to keep unwanted people out?
Well, I'd better lock it then.
There he is, harmless, sexless Urkel from Family Matters, a television character that seemed to embody everything awkward, everything repugnant, the kid you teased, that you shunned. Harmless, laughable, nerdy Urkel. That guy will never get a date, right? Well, reexamining those assumptions about young men shunned, sexual underdogs, nerdy adolescents fighting for female attention has been the conversation this week following the shooting in Santa Barbara. Elliot Rodgers' rampage and rage against women has become a parable of gender culture in America. Those events motivated freelance writer and Jeopardy champion Arthur Chu to take a long, honest look at himself and his attitudes about women in an essay for the Daily Beast. It references, among other things, another seemingly harmless icon of nerd culture, Mario Brothers. The title of Arthur Chu's piece is "Your Princess is in Another Castle."
For a long time, I feel like people in like so-called nerd culture, people who identified with, you know, this subculture of being the underdog, we all knew there were these problems going on. We were all aware of it. In high school and college, I knew that there were a lot of people I knew who had negative attitudes about women and treated women badly. But you didn't talk about it because you wanted to present a sort of unified front. It's like we've all been picked on, we've all been bullied, and we've got to stick together. But Roger is kind of an indictment, just like this is the rock bottom. This is where this kind of thing goes, the sense of entitlement, the sense of like male victimhood, that men deserve something from women and have this righteous anger if they don't get it. You know, it eventually leads to a total atrocity like this. And people have to speak out and just say, look, it's not acceptable. The attitude that underlies this is not acceptable. Mental illness or no mental illness, you know, this mass shootings don't happen every day, but this kind of resentment and hatred of women based on this feeling of entitlement, it does happen every day, and we need to speak up about it.
Well, let's step back for a second, because I think everyone can absolutely agree with you that, you know, taking matters into your own hands violently is unacceptable. But it's this sort of subtle element of entitlement that creeps into popular culture that I think is the basis of your piece's power here. And let's listen to something from Revenge of the Nerds, which you actually referred to in the story.
We're allowed to have girls in our dorm room?
Not girls, Gil. Women. We're college men now.
Isn't college great?
It's going to be a great year.
Ha 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 ha. But not today.
Well, I've been accused by some critics after this piece went viral of picking on awkward guys or trying to make guys ashamed of being attracted to girls. And that's sort of that particular clip, that's sort of the uncomfortable, you know, subtext there. And I don't think anybody doesn't deserve to find love or find happiness because they're awkward or because they have a tough time talking to people. But I really feel like the pendulum has swung to the point where it feels like our society is more on the side of awkward guys and is saying, like, awkward guys, you deserve a chance, that a woman who, you know, judges you or doesn't want to be with you is being a jerk, is being unfair, that we're putting an onus on women.
Well, let's think about that for a second, because, you know, you could make an argument, and some have, that programs, content, movies that celebrate the loser guy is kind of an outlet, that if we think of him as a hero in some playful way, he's less likely to be in his room, you know, writing manifestos. Listen to this little scene from The Big Bang Theory.
Howard, why don't we just work on the robot?
Oh, please, Leonard, not now. Once again, Penny and I have begun our little tango.
Our tango?
The carnal repartee, the erotic to and fro.
What do you think about that?
We have a lot of problems with men and women relating to each other, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing that we have these stereotypes, like if he's needling you, if he's screwing with you, if he's pulling your pigtails, he's really into you. You know, yeah, I know we all have trouble expressing our feelings, but a lot of women who have this like laid on them, like, hey, antagonism and hostility from guys is okay because you should be flattered because it means that you're desirable and you should want to be desired by guys. That really can mess with your head. I mean, ultimately, I'm not saying that guys shouldn't tell these stories about their own experience, but we do have a huge bias in our culture for telling these stories from the guy's perspective and not like, how does it feel to be the one pursued with this kind of like, you know, needy grasping entitlement, or to be the one who's like getting negative attention because it's displaced attraction? You know, how does it feel to have to deal with that and you're just trying to live your life?
Well, check this out.
If that makes any sense.
Oh, it does. And there's actually a great little scene that we found in The Big Bang Theory that purports anyway to deliver this women's perspective here. Listen.
It is not sexy to stare at my ass and say, ooh, it must be jelly because jam don't shake like that. And most important, we are not dancing a tango. We're not to-ing and fro-ing. Nothing is ever going to happen between us, ever.
Wait a minute. This isn't flirting. You're serious.
Flirting? You think I'm flirting with you? I am not flirting with you. No woman is ever going to flirt with you. You're just going to grow old and die alone.
You know, that last line is so terrifying in light of what's happened in the last week. But that is sort of this cliche that, if you're a nerd, then you are going to live in some prison of your own antisocial, like, isolation.
That scene is kind of – I see it as a kind of catharsis. And so this is the problem with having this conversation is no, I don't think it's okay to, like, grab a guy by the collar and yell at him, you're going to die alone. You deserve to die alone. But – it's not any woman's job to make sure that you don't die alone. It's not any woman's obligation to give you a chance. And we really do put a lot of pressure on women to say, like, you have to, you should, you know, you should give a guy a fair hearing. You should give a guy an opportunity, that you are being, you know, pardon the language, you're being a bitch if you reject a guy outright, you know. That women sort of have a responsibility to let passes be made at them. And it reaches a point where there are women who feel stalked and harassed in a community of nerdy people. Like, I've been around a lot of socially awkward, you know, intellectual girls, gifted girls, who when they end up in a situation where guys feel like, this is my chance, this is a girl who, you know, should be with me, this is my chance to, like, get all the things that I've always wanted, you know, it's like blood in a shark tank. I mean, we talked about Revenge of the Nerds. Like, there was a point in time when this sense of entitlement was so strong that it was okay to show fantasies. I said that in my article, Revenge of the Nerds, it culminates in a rape scene. It is a rape scene that Lewis, through deception, has sex with his rival's girlfriend, and she falls in love with him because he does it so well. That's a nerdy twist on what, if you like change the context, would very clearly be, you know, a very ugly scene of, you know, I raped her and she likes it, of conquering a woman through force. The fact that it's through intellectual trickery and deception rather than force, that it's a nerd narrative, so to speak, rather than a jock narrative, doesn't change the fact that this is a fantasy about, you know, possessing women, a fantasy about not having to deal with the fear that a woman might make the choice to tell you, I don't care. I don't care if you die alone. But
well, that's the key, because the freakiest thing of all about this conversation is that we both know we would not be having it except for the existence of firearms. That if you know, this guy had done nothing in Santa Barbara, this would all be part of this kind of hidden sexual tension, adolescent, you know, weirdness that constitutes sexual culture in America. But because somebody pulls the trigger and people die, we're suddenly having a conversation. That's not an endorsement of guns, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The fact that we have to wait until someone is mentally ill enough and screwed up enough to do something this big and destructive and self-destructive. And there's a lot of guys who are really, really misogynist and are not crazy enough to destroy their lives over it, but so they find ways to hurt women that they can get away with, and it happens every day. And it's only when an Elliot Rodger comes along that and literally leaves this huge manifesto about it that people say, hey, maybe this misogyny thing is a real problem in our society, maybe this is actually an issue. That's why we need to be having this conversation. And people talk about politicizing this tragedy. You know, and I'm saying, I think that the only valid reason for those of us who are not personally affected to hear about this in the news and talk about it is to try to prevent things from happening in the future. You know?
Well, I suspect this week you may have gotten some indication that you're, you know, on the short list to be, you know, sensitive male of the year.
I mean, well, the thing that I would say is that sensitive guy of the year or whatever, I have my own skeletons in my closet. As I said in my piece, like, I feel the reason I need to talk about this is because I've been through it. I would like to think never in a million years would I end up in the same place that Elliot Rodger did, but I've felt resentment of women. I've treated women badly in the past. You know, I can admit that. I need to admit that. And I think the important thing is for men who are struggling with this kind of thing, who've been through this, to stand up and take responsibility, one, and to tell other guys, look, this worldview is twisted. This worldview is hurting you as much as it's hurting people around you. I hope more guys can come out and say that, because guys need to have this conversation with each other. It can't just be women, you know, demanding for men to listen for a second and men just moving on with their lives.
Arthur Chu, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Arthur Chu is a freelance columnist for the Daily Beast, author of the article Your Princess is in Another Castle, Misogyny, Entitlement, and Nerds. You can find a link to that article by just visiting thetakeaway.org. Stereotypes, sexual attitudes. What if we could just look under the hood of our culture, find the settings panel, and adjust them all? What would you delete or turn off?
Stereotype that I most wish would go away is that gay guys dress well. Because, personally, I don't care what I'm wearing. Jeans and a t-shirt works for me.
Dave from Huntington, New York, joins the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Kimberly from Detroit references a very familiar guy assumption about women. I, Kimberly says, can read a map perfectly well. I can give and take driving directions with or without landmarks, and I know which way north is. Natalie, East Meadow, Long Island. One of the sexist stereotypes that I despise is the one that claims Spanish girls are easy. Not true at all.
This is Jim Myers, and I'm from Alameda, California. What sexist stereotype do I most wish would go away? That maternal instincts trump paternal instincts. That advertisers do not target fathers very often when promoting parenting consumer goods. And that fathers are not as capable as mothers when choosing child custody.
Patrick from Fort Covington, New York, adds this. That being a man means the only things we care about is sex and cars.
Hi, my name is Daryl Willis. I'm from West Palm Beach, Florida. I'd like to put to rest the notion that men default to rapists, because that puts the onus on women to remain virginal, or else they provoke the male monsters, which is just sexist all around. Need to quit.
Hi, this is Michael from Seattle. I don't like the stereotype that men need a car to be considered good boyfriend material, and I wish that this stereotype would go away.
I'm with you, Michael. Patty on Facebook. That women are emotional, that women talk more than men, that women don't have a sense of direction. Which stereotypes, sexist stereotypes, gender stereotypes would you love to do away with? Keep the discussion going. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post at thetakeaway.org. Of course, there is enormous sexual tension growing up for men and women in the U.S. everywhere. Sorting out what is learned misogynist behavior and what is playful experimentation that passes with adolescence is complicated by the digital culture. It's a global story this week. Google has launched a service to allow Europeans to ask for personal data to be removed from online search results, regrettable emails and the like, a right to be forgotten, something the CEO of Snapchat, Evan Spiegel, may be wishing was a right in the USA, as the tech gossip website ValleyWag recently leaked emails from Spiegel's undergraduate days at Stanford University in 2010. Silly, druggy, nasty stuff, some of it about women. Alyssa Shavinsky is a CEO in the same business space as Snapchat, the so-called ephemeral social app space. Alyssa says bad boy behavior is actually a driver of the whole ephemeral business model. Alyssa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So there's lots to talk about here this week. I mean, this is a really turmoil, bubbling week, you know, on the sort of cultural questions of ephemeral content online, you know, the questions of what that content says about people. Let's just right at the outset, you're kind of a competitor with Evan Spiegel's Snapchat, right?
I'm not a direct competitor in the sense that people will use multiple messaging apps, but yes, I'm CEO of an ephemeral messaging company.
And, you know, it, just as a CEO, how would you sort of describe this kind of firestorm that Evan Spiegel is involved with these undergraduate Stanford University emails, some of which are, you know, pretty offensive to women?
Well, the emails certainly do paint a portrait of consistent misogyny, but it's interesting in terms of product founder fit. You know, you can see how Spiegel has consistently said that Snapchat is not a sexting app, that it's instead about whimsy and about being in the moment. And that makes sense in light of seeing that he had things that he regrets are being surfaced now.
So he actually, his misogyny makes an argument for ephemerality in the sense that people are saying things that they definitely don't want to hang around.
And, you know, Spiegel isn't the only one. In the early days of the internet, it was really a challenge to keep your data around. You know, if you remember the internet in the late 90s and early 2000s, data storage was a real struggle. And these days, we're overwhelmed by persistent data. We wish that we didn't have so many emails and so many files and things coming back to haunt us on social media. I think that's a real case for ephemerality. The internet was never meant to be this place that haunts us.
Well, but now let's take a look. We've just had this huge conversation on the program with Arthur Chu about the question of latent misogyny being revealed by this horrible incident in Santa Barbara, part of which was enabled by, you know, postings on the internet. Suddenly, if all of this is latent, ephemerality contributes to hiding behavior rather than revealing behavior. And I'm wondering if that's such a good idea all of a sudden.
Well, you know, that is an interesting point. But bad actors will certainly reveal themselves. That people who were doing terrible things 5 years ago, it still shows up now. I think that people do deserve the opportunity to reinvent themselves and have second chances. And that was certainly the story, you know, with my own co-founder who said things online that he regretted. And then his actions showed that that wasn't how he wanted to represent himself. And that wasn't who he wanted to be. Unfortunately, with Snapchat, we don't necessarily see the CEO's apologies being manifest in actions yet, but maybe they will. You know, maybe we'll see Evan Spiegel deciding that they want to take a really strong women in tech stance. That would be great.
Let's talk about Google for a second, because the Europeans have a whole different idea about this. I mean, they say you have a right to forget stuff, and Google is going to put in software that will allow people in Europe to basically pull down links that they believe should be forgotten, even though they're now a part of the public internet record. Do you think that sort of thing is valid? And when does redemption from past activities that you regret become manipulation of your brand, essentially a kind of concealment?
Well, I love the idea of giving people more control over their identities and more control over what shows up online. And that's very important in cases of mistakes or cases where, for example, people did things in the past and repaired them and simply want to move on. I think people should have the right to reinvent themselves. But more importantly, people should have the right to control their own identities.
Would you say that part of this discussion comes out of the culture of the Valley, the culture of the tech world, that, you know, it is a lot of guys, you know, staring at a lot of screens and sharing a lot of sort of goofy notions about women and dating, and that some of these apps even come directly out of that? And I'm wondering if you have to fight that every day.
I think it's important that people appreciate that Snapchat isn't part of that so directly. They're based in L.A., that actually tells us that this kind of misogyny isn't only in Silicon Valley. We see that with, you know, the shootings as well. Like this is tech nerds. This is a nerd thing. You could make the argument that it's nerd entitlement, but it's deeper than that. What I see happening in Silicon Valley is the problem of gender imbalance in a day-to-day way that messes things up for everyone. When you have guys in an environment where they're just not meeting women and not interacting with women because women aren't around, it leads to really odd behaviors.
All right, before we go, I mean, there are people out there, you know, listening to public radio going, oh, great, Hockenberry and public radio has figured out a way for us to hate nerds now. Political correctness is just, you know, metastasized. What would you say to those people?
I'd say I love nerds. And it's way more complicated than that. And what we're seeing now is, as a culture, we've come to embrace nerds and geeks and their values. And we're seeing now that nerds and geeks are running the world. And for the most part, that's great. But now that as a culture, we no longer stigmatize nerds, it gives us the space to examine the nerd psychology more closely.
Alyssa Chavinsky is CEO of Glimpse, which is a private ephemeral photo sharing app. She spoke with us from New York. Thanks, Alyssa.
Thank you.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
No more. Hang on.
I'm trying to use the phone.
Friday Movie Time with the Movie Date podcast team. Producer for the Sporkful podcast, Kristen Meinzer, and Newsday film critic Rafer Guzman. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
So we got three movies, and they're all pretty darn big. Let's begin with actually the smallest of the three, and we've got an interview with Jesse Eisenberg coming right up. So Night Moves. Kristen, what did you think?
Now, this is the story of some environmental activists, you might call them eco-terrorists, who embark on a mission, and there are three of them, and whenever there are three people, you know that there are going to be some disagreements about how things work out.
And unlike, The Social Network, this is not a movie that's filled with lots and lots of dialogue. Listen.
Which way are you going back?
26, across the mountain. It's out of the way, but there's more traffic. We can blend in.
When we split up, we shouldn't talk on the phone.
Yeah, no way. Yeah, no contact. No contact.
No contact.
Yeah.
Very conspiratorial, very dark. What did you think?
Well, I have to say that there is some suspense here. There's definitely that exploration of, are you good? Am I good? Are we on the same team here?
Radicalism.
And radicalism and all of that, and that's kind of fun. I think it's going to be very slow and atmospheric for some viewers.
Now, we might call the next movie, a Disney offering, Princess Leia meets the Devil's Horns, Maleficent, with Elle Fanning and Angelina Jolie.
I know you're there. Don't be afraid.
I am not afraid.
Then come out.
Then you'll be afraid.
Is Disney trying to create a franchise with this evil character? Is it based on anything? I've seen the posters everywhere, and I love Angelina Jolie.
It reminds me a little bit of Wicked, the Broadway show, where you see the bad guys actually possibly being good guys and what happened to them to make them that way. And I love the idea of this story. Unfortunately, the execution at times seems tonally really off. Sometimes it feels like a sci-fi action movie. Sometimes it feels like it should be a cartoon with Tinkerbell. It's kind of all over
the Warrior Witch kind of thing.
Exactly.
Couldn't figure it out.
All over the place. And it's too bad because I really love the idea of it. And I actually think Angelina Jolie is a pretty great villain in this.
All right. So comic relief to finish out our movies. A Million Ways to Die in the West. Here's one.
This is Anna. She's...
I'm his girlfriend.
She's my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
She's the new GF. Big time.
A lot of sexual activity.
All the time.
This is the Wild West meets Marin County, it seems like, Rafer. Seth MacFarlane, Charlize Theron, Neil Patrick Harris. This is a talented cast.
You hear them all there, including a little bit of Amanda Seyfried as Seth MacFarlane's ex-girlfriend. He plays a cowardly sheep farmer who's ill-equipped to deal with the violent West. Charlize Theron plays the wife of a gunslinger who comes to town. And
comedy is hard. Is it hard for these guys?
I think it actually works really well. I think it depends on if you're a Seth MacFarlane fan. He's gotten a lot of criticism for being a bit frat boyish, chauvinist, sexist, perhaps racist. There are a few of those moments in this film, no doubt about it. But I think it works mainly because of him and Theron. I think they make a really good couple. There's a really tender romance at the heart of this film, despite all the poop jokes and the crude humor. It's got a heart, and I think it works. And I thought it was actually very funny.
Sounds very boyish. Sounds very white.
Kristen,
very boyish,
very white.
Hate it.
I would agree that it's very boyish and very white. And if you love poo jokes, if you love diarrhea jokes, if you love fart jokes,
yes.
If you love throw-up jokes, if you love sex jokes, you're probably going to love this movie. But the humor doesn't go much beyond that. If you're looking for anything smarter or more interesting than that, you're going to probably not love it.
Well, nobody looked for smart in Ted, that's for sure, and it was a success. On the podcast this week?
This week we have our full interview with Clive Owen talking about his new indie flick, Words and Pictures.
Nice. Newsday film critic Rafer Guzman, Sporkful podcast producer Kristen Meinzer, the Movie Date podcast. Check it out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, great weekend, John.
Actor Jesse Eisenberg stars in one of the movies opening this weekend, and he stopped by to speak about the challenge of playing an angry, antisocial environmental terrorist.
Okay, look. It's not what anyone wanted. But the guy is probably fine. We don't know anything.
You said no one would get hurt. But they did.
We don't know that, but it's natural for you to feel so upset.
Night Moves is the film, and it also stars Dakota Fanning and Peter Sarsgaard. It's an exploration of how a frustration with the world can explode into violent action with unexpected consequences.
There's this great dichotomy in the film of the character working on this farm that is kind of living in an environmentally responsible way, but not affecting that many people outside the farm. And the character who I play thinks that it's an insufficient contribution to the environmental cause. He sees himself as a soldier in a war, and working on a farm is kind of nice and good, he thinks, but ultimately not effective enough. And so that kind of personal rage takes him to the point of blowing up a dam.
You totally embrace the character of some scraggly bearded ideologue wearing the hat. Mm-hmm. I can see you with a 30-06 on your back easily.
Right. Yeah, it was an interesting character to play. You know, he kind of is a guy who he's so introverted. He doesn't really know what to say because I think he feels like not only a kind of this great rage, but I think he feels so unsure of himself. You know, it's like this is a guy, it's not explicit in the movie, but I think it's a guy who, you know, most likely grew up on the East Coast and probably a middle class home and, you know, became increasingly dogmatic and also kind of increasingly probably frustrated with his own upbringing and his own privilege and is now turned away from all of that and doesn't know who he is. And therefore he kind of becomes introverted and rageful.
When you think about this character and it's, you know, sort of, I suppose, very public radio to psychoanalyze these things on the air. But do you find that it's a short or a long path to radicalization? Did you find after doing this work that, wow, I'm not as far from that as I thought, or, boy, that's completely out there on a limb, and I hope I never get there?
Well, you know, at the risk of, like, further delving into psychoanalyzation, like, you know, my dad teaches a sociology class and kind of discusses modern politics, like the two extremes of like extreme liberal and extreme, you know, conservative are actually much more psychologically aligned than somebody who'd be moderate, even though their political positions couldn't be more diametrically opposed. And I think, like, you know, for my character in this, you know, I think probably whatever kind of dogmatism he currently has probably occurred fairly quickly.
What was the collaboration like? You were on location pretty much for the whole shoot. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, I used to live out in the Pacific Northwest. It's an easy place to get immersed in.
Yeah, it really is. You know, it was also interesting just driving along the highways and seeing trucks pulling, you know, dozens and dozens of, you know, recently cut trees and passing clear cuts and then going to do a movie about, you know, somebody who is personally and realistically emotionally destroyed by clear cuts and motivated exclusively by the kind of terror he feels by them.
Clear cuts are where loggers go in and take down an entire mountainside of trees. There's not selective thinning. There's no forest left. It's just a mud flat when it's done.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking looking, especially because it's like kind of this very specific line from where the trees were cut to where, you know, the trees begin again. So it's a very shocking image.
There's a scene early on in the movie of a kind of a group meeting of this set of activists, and they're talking about their should we do something that will affect a lot of people, or should we do just a lot of little things, and should we worry about ourselves, or should we worry about the world? It was a real kind of remarkable introspective look at how young people are grappling with some of these big problems.
But Jackie, I'm curious what you think it is exactly that we're supposed to do. Do you have some sort of big plan or?
I think this one big plan thinking leads to a lot of the problems we're facing. Part of the idea for me is not thinking there's just one big thing. I'm not focused on big plans, I'm focused on small plans. A lot of small plans.
Yeah, no, it was a beautiful scene because it showed, I think, in a kind of very subtle and realistic way, the kind of very complicated grappling that activists do with issues. In that particular scene, my character is thinking he's going to bomb a dam, and he's looking at this person who made a documentary with such hatred because he thinks, you are doing nothing, you self-aggrandizing, narcissistic, self-serving, inefficient documentary filmmaker. You know, I think because he looks at them and say, you know, you're actually hurting the movement because you claim to be helping the movement and you're actually not doing anything.
God knows what he would think of, like, public radio hosts.
Those tote bags are not made from, you know, appropriately harvested hemp.
Yeah. Well, Jesse Eisenberg, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Jesse Eisenberg stars in the new movie Night Moves. It opens in theaters this weekend. Egypt has elected a new president this week, a 92% victory for Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, former military chief with virtually no opposition in a nation where the Arab Spring suddenly seems like a distant memory. The lack of opposition suggests that the political openness of 2010 has gone away, either because of a new military crackdown or because of a deep civic weariness with instability, the vanished tourism dollars, the struggling economy, and a government unable to govern. One sign of a return to the days of Hosni Mubarak and the military rule in Egypt is the trial of three journalists accused of aiding a terrorist organization when they claim they were simply trying to get the Muslim Brotherhood's perspective on the Egyptian situation. The Brotherhood is now banned, but a year ago was one of the elected majority parties in Egypt. The trial of the Al Jazeera journalists is coming down to a verdict, possibly next week. Al Jazeera English senior correspondent Sue Turton is actually one of the accused in this case, but was out of the country when charges were filed against her and has watched her own trial, her powerless colleagues and fellow defendants in Cairo from afar.
It's incredibly frustrating, as you can appreciate. The fact that I've been accused of aiding and abetting terrorism has had an impact on me. I can't really do my job at the moment because there are many countries that very much sympathize and are backing Egypt in its current form. But it's nothing compared to what my three colleagues are going through. They've been incarcerated now for over 150 days for basically just doing their job. And one of them has serious medical problems, Mohamed Fahmy, who's half Egyptian, half Canadian. He has a broken shoulder that's sort of set in the wrong position. He had to sleep on a stone floor for the first 2 months with no mattress and no bedding. And it's really, you know, it's taken its toll on his health. The other two guys, they now get an hour out of the prison cell that they all share each day. They just run as much as they can just to try and get those endorphins going. But you can appreciate every time we have another court session, morale just really drops because they think this could be it when the judge recognizes these charges are just politically driven and that it should be thrown out of court.
With the election of General al-Sisi as leader of Egypt, does this become a show trial or is it something that he perhaps wishes would just go away?
I think it's always been a show trial. I think one of the reasons that it happened in the first place is because all of the domestic media in Egypt sort of toes the government line. It's always been very backing of the government. It knows it has to be, otherwise it will be shut down. And because Al Jazeera is still shown in Egypt, they had to shut us up. But apart from just that, I think the knock-on effects of that has been many other news channels from around the world that have covered Egypt are almost self-censoring or muting their kind of coverage of Egypt. And that's really, I think, half the reason that this trial is going on, because Egypt just wants to really shut any reporting of the sort of human rights abuses that are going on, the amount of people that are being thrown into prison that don't agree with the government, and the fact there isn't really a judicial process for them.
Do you think the fact that the U.S. has come out in very vocal support of you actually might hurt your case politically inside of Egypt?
I don't think so. I know that Egypt has been quite strong in its reaction when the military aid was cut by some level last October. I was actually in the country in Cairo covering that story. But in the end of the day, I think the relationship between Egypt and the US has been held for decades. And even though Egypt might not say this publicly, I really think that the Egyptians value the fact that there's been this partnership with the US for so long. You can see that they really want to keep those ties and the sort of the dialogue open. And I think one of the main reasons for that is finance. I think really that they want to draw more American finance back into the country. The country's economy is on its knees. They want to get Americans to go back to visit to the pyramids, to Sharm el-Sheikh, because tourism has dropped dramatically. And they're really, the whole of the country's feeling that. But what I'm really hoping, what we're really hoping, is the fact the American government has said you have to demonstrate you are on the right road to democracy, this roadmap to democracy that they've talked about. You have to demonstrate that by two things, by releasing those that are in prison just because of their political views, by allowing political assembly and freedom of expression. And you also have to stop locking up journalists who are just doing their job.
Here's a possibly more sensitive question. I'm wondering if the involvement of the Emir of Qatar in regional politics is also a complication for you folks working for Al Jazeera, that perhaps you've been singled out because of the Egyptians' particular views of the involvement of Qatar in everything that's gone on in the Arab Spring.
I think that actually must have fed into it. And I don't think any of us have shied away from that point, because Qatar as a government was very much backing the Muslim Brotherhood in many ways, not just politically, but financially as well. There was a definite shift when the coup happened against Qatar in Egypt. And, you know, people have said that is the whole reason for what's happened. But as I said earlier, I think there are many reasons. And I think trying to shut up any derision against the government is possibly one of the biggest ones. But also, the fact that Al Jazeera English was the only staff in country at the time, I think, is one of the reasons that we were arrested. The only way that they could have an impact on Al Jazeera, and as you say, possibly also on Qatar, is by picking up the three guys that I worked with all last year, or at least two of them, and Peter Grester. And Peter Grester had been in country for 2 weeks when they picked him up. He had done magnificent work across in the east of Africa for Al Jazeera for many years. He's an award-winning journalist. But he was covering our holiday cover for Christmas. When he was picked up, how unlucky can you be with your timing? Well, we stand by our journalism. We say we were as fair and independent and transparent as in our reporting that, you know, we could possibly be. But in the end of the day, it just really does feel like all these things have come together in, I suppose, a kind of perfect storm. The fact that Qatar has upset the Egyptians, the fact that Al Jazeera doesn't toe the party line.
Finally, you know, the possibilities here on the verdict range everything from time served to the death penalty. Any speculation here?
We've been told that the kind of verdicts could be very different from the Egyptians and from the for the foreigners, if you like. But the speculation I've heard mostly from legal sources is a kind of 15 years. I mean, obviously, if the verdict is a guilty one, we will go straight into an appeal. And who knows? I mean, maybe one of the first things that the new president will do is pardon. Who knows? Who knows whether he thinks that is a good way to demonstrate that he is going to bring in these democratic principles that the rest of the Western world, at least, is really pushing Egypt to go down. If there is a guilty verdict, that's really what we're hoping for.
Sue Turton is a senior correspondent for Al Jazeera English, one of the accused journalists in this case. We spoke with her from Greece. Thank you, Sue.
You're welcome.
Anyone out there counting carbon units?
The carbon units know why the creator has not responded.
Disclose the information.
Not until Vija withdraws the devices orbiting the third planet.
Captain, I'm losing Starfleet. Interference from Vija.
Trekkie nerds out there will certainly recognize that clip from the very first Star Trek movie about a dorky little satellite's love affair with humans, with carbon units. But the Obama administration may be seriously counting carbon units. The administration will announce next week its approach to dealing with carbon emissions, possibly revisiting a policy that was dubbed a carbon tax by Tea Party conservatives and was dead on arrival in the U.S. Congress a few years back. But the marketing of carbon emissions permits, carbon units, the so-called cap-and-trade approach, is gaining steam around the world. In California and Europe, a cap-and-trade system is already in place. Industries have to buy permits to emit. But if they can reduce their own emissions or invest in other carbon-reducing ventures, they can reduce their costs. Does it work? Well, let's just say there is much less consensus about cap-and-trade's effectiveness than there is about the existence of global warming. That's pretty much what you discover, Justin Gillis, environmental science and policy reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Do I have that about right?
You've got it right.
And the idea that cap and trade will work theoretically seems pretty clear, but in practice, it's been pretty different around the world. Explain your experience.
That's true. There have certainly been some troubling experiences, and most particularly in Europe. Europe sort of went first with this approach to global warming pollution. So they were pioneers, and they've been pretty ambitious. It's a huge system that covers 31 countries, but they got a lot wrong in the early days. And as we speak, in 2014, almost 10 years after they started, they still haven't fixed it all. And so a lot of people have looked at the European experience and said, wait a minute, is this really where we want to be putting our effort into solving global warming?
And let me just step back for a second. We'll do a couple of numbers here. It's my sense from reading your piece in the New York Times that the consensus is that if the cap and trade, vouchers or units or whatever you want to call them, the permits, go for $30 a ton of carbon, that is the level at which you're really encouraging industries to reduce their carbon. Much below that, and it's simply a license to pollute. Is that roughly about right?
You get different views about this. A lot of people think, quite intelligent people think we need to sort of start low and gradually work our way into this. Of course, the problem itself is urgent, and we've got to get to a point of fairly quickly figuring out how to limit emissions. Yes, in answer to your question, many of the experts who look at this come to the conclusion that in the ballpark of $30 a ton of pollution, that's enough of a bite that it would really begin to encourage people to transition to cleaner energy sources. But there's been success. There's a program in the northeastern United States, 9 states, with a carbon price that's been as low as $2 a ton over the last few years, and yet they have made gains. They have managed to cut back their emissions. So I don't think it's axiomatic that we need a really high carbon price. It's one of the things that people debate about this.
And if cap and trade does become part of the debate once again, people are going to point to Europe as being something of a fiasco in the early going. Have they learned their lesson? Are there ways of fixing that system over there? What are the chief problems in Europe?
Well, one of the chief problems was early on, they didn't really get a very good inventory of how much greenhouse gases they had. You're the government and you're about to set a cap. And so you go out and ask the polluters, well, how much are you emitting now? If you don't audit that very carefully, they have an obvious incentive to exaggerate, right? Because they're about to be subject to limits. They've since fixed that problem with better auditing. And they had a bunch of other problems like that that basically boiled down to sort of loose rules at the outset, but they still haven't, as I said, they still have not entirely fixed it. They've got a huge oversupply of carbon permits in Europe, and so their price, carbon price, is only a little above $7 a ton right now, and they just pretty much nobody over there thinks that's high enough to encourage industry to meet the long-term goals.
Finally, is there a technology issue here in the sense that, we're not simply talking about, rough estimates of pollution, that to make this work, you have to really upgrade the extent to which you can audit, down to the fraction of a ton of all these industries. Otherwise, these pieces of paper, as they discovered in Europe, could be utterly worthless. Do we have the technology and even the institutions in place to do that level of really strict carbon monitoring?
That's certainly true, John. You do need to do that. And the probably constructive case or instructive case here is California, which has the most ambitious of these systems in the United States, operating now for about 18 months. And California spent years getting their emissions data right because it's so critical to the success of the system. And I think a lot of people would tell you, yes, the state of California has figured out how to do pretty good monitoring of this. For that matter, Europe now has pretty good monitoring. So it can be done. It requires, a whole, as you might imagine, a whole sort of infrastructure of third-party kind of certifiers who look at emissions data, who look at energy consumption data. So it's not trivial. That's certainly true. But I think the general consensus would be that can be done.
And if California's system is scaled up for the entire nation, if that's the direction the Obama administration wants to go, or even something like it, does anyone believe there's a stomach in the Congress for actually implementing something like this?
Well, what President Obama is going to do, and he does not need congressional approval to do this, is he's going to use the Clean Air Act to set limits on pollution, carbon pollution for the states. The states then have to decide how to comply with those limits. The administration is not going to tell them, we want you to go to, you know, carbon trading or any other system. They may, they certainly may present that as a list of options, but they're going to allow the states to decide how to meet the limits. The thinking among the experts is that many states will choose to do this sort of system that California and the Northeast states have because it's the path of least resistance. We have models now showing that it can work. And so the idea is this will just be the easiest way for people to comply. There is a question about whether Congress will try to block this. Once the regulation is final, and that will not happen for another year, the Congress can take a vote on whether to block it. And, of course, the Republicans in Congress want to block it, so many of them do. And so we will have to see if they manage to have that vote and pull that off.
A fairly big hint of the debate and discussion that will begin next week as the administration really announces its regulatory policy on dealing with carbon emissions. Justin Gillis covers environmental science and policy for our partner, The New York Times. Justin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be watching the national conversation in the Washington, D.C. debate about how best to regulate carbon and whether cap and trade is the best option in your state or region. We'll also take you into the weekend with the provocative conversation inspired by Daily Beast columnist Arthur Chu.
I have my own skeletons in my closet. I feel the reason I need to talk about this is because I've been through it. I would like to think never in a million years would I end up in the same place that Elliot Rodger did, but I've felt resentment of women. I've treated women badly in the past. You know, I can admit that. I need to admit that.
So one of you in Texas might have a lot to say to Arthur. Gender stereotypes can distort people's behavior. The manly man stereotype you want to eliminate, it not only forces men into a mold, but by its position forces women into a compatible role. A woman would not be expected to serve as a housewife, for example, if being a stay-at-home dad was cool. Thanks for your thoughts. Thanks for the conversation. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.